it occurred to me after my talk was all good to go that I'm not sure how well the beginning of the talk is adapted to this audience. On the other hand, there's something of a mixed audience, so I don't know. It begins with an introduction to what is quantum probability, but a lot of you sort of already know that. But still, there are some points to emphasize. So the convention of this meeting, although a lot of people are saying non-commutative probability rather than quantum, is just in general, something is classical if it's commutative and quantum if it's non-commutative. But in the case of probability theory, this means something much more specific. And I didn't say anything about free probability in this talk, but I should have. And so the main thing I want to say is free probability is not what I'm talking about. But it's important to stick to the it's important to stick to the distinctions. So what I list here is the basic idea is that classical probability you can define classical probability as the theory of commutative Feynman algebras. The bounded random variables on a probabilistic space makes a commutative Feynman algebra, and then on the other hand, usually for most sigma algebras, and you get almost all of the interesting examples this way. And so then you have quantum probability if you replace the commutative Feynman algebras by non-commutative Feynman algebras. So one of the things that makes probability interesting is not just that it's a theory of mathematics, but that it's true. That is, it's true in science in general. It's a correct model of economics and science, gambling, all of that stuff. And this truth of probability also makes it more useful, at least to people who, even if you want to do pure mathematics, it gives it extra intuitive strength and more applications. I mean, one famous example of that is the probabilistic method for showing existence of combinatorial structures, which really, at least in the way that it's explained, relies on the empirical truth of probability. So part of my interest in quantum probability is that it's also true. This generalization of probability is necessary to describe quantum physics, of course. But in explaining this talk, what I want to say is that it's not free. There's also free probability, which is another kind of quantum probability, which, at least as far as I know, isn't true in the same way. I mean, it's true mathematics, and it's excellent mathematics, and it also could later be used as a model for true physics, that as a correct model for some physics. But I don't know that that's been done. It is okay. Okay. So this is known. Oh, okay. Well, it's the Lardin Lumen of Gauge theory. Okay. Well, with the standard, just for my talk, I am taking quantum probability with the standard tensor product, not with the free product. And that one is true. That theory is true rather much earlier than the Lardin Lumen of Gauge theory. It's the correct probabilistic model for quantum mechanics already. Now, again, this. If you really take this philosophy to heart, and Dan and others really have, so this is really a non-message for them, but I can say that in physics this is done less. There's a tendency to explain quantum mechanics as a two-level theory, where at one level you have unitary operators and so on, and then on top of that you have probability. The answers are then interpreted as statistical. Well, you don't need this two-level thing. If you say an observable in quantum probability, then that is, say, a self-adjoint element of the Feynman algebra, and that's just exactly the same thing as a random variable. Right. So it's sort of more necessary to to equate these things and not have this ad hoc two-level description in pre-probability anyway. But certainly I wish that this lesson was taken more to heart everywhere else in quantum information theory and every quantum mechanics course maybe, but it isn't done. Okay. So I can go really quickly through this, maybe. Okay. So to review, this is one description of classical probability. You can just start out by saying that we would like an algebra of random variables, so let's take it to be a commutative Neumann algebra. And then that already defines a kind of probability space, but a naked one without a state. I think it's kind of optional whether you choose a state or not. But then what should be a state? The von Neumann algebra has certain closure properties so that it has a pre-dual as a Banach space, and then the state is a certain kind of pre-dual vector. So you can take it with those axioms, you can define probability with those axioms, and then later it's revealed that every commutative von Neumann algebra is the L-infinity algebra of a sigma algebra omega and so on. If you were to teach, a graduate course in commutative probability and you did it this way, then you would go through, working from this end, you would define a real random variable as one that's self-adjoint, positive if it's one that's of the form y star y, and then a state is a pre-dual vector that's positive on positive elements, and it should be normalized usually, so rho of 1 should be 1. So then in particular, states are probability distributions. They're non-commutative probability distributions. On this slide, it would just be a definition. A probability distribution is a state. It's just state is a better term because it's just one syllable. So then the quantum version is just that, all the same stuff, except you just remove commutativity. We can think about some examples of quantum probability spaces. Again, this is maybe not news to most of you guys, but we can broaden our horizons a little bit and consider also, for instance, quantum computation. The first non-commutative example is a 2x2 matrix algebra. That's some kind of quantum probability space. It's hard, you won't get any smaller than that and be non-commutative, and let's just give that one a name. That one's called a qubit. And then quantum computation is essentially the computational power of qubits. Let's say the category of finite dimensional von Neumann algebras together with reasonable local, the category as generated by local operations. Now, of course, again, another lesson that you may not need, if the quantum probability space is all of the bounded operators in Hilbert space, then there are pure states which are dual vectors that are of this form specifically, and if your view is a little bit narrow, then you'll only think of the pure states and not the others, and then you'll get the vector description of quantum mechanics. In a sense, you can describe everything in quantum mechanics this way because every von Neumann algebra is a subalgebra of all of the bounded operators. But this is sort of like studying group theory by defining only symmetric groups and saying, well, every other group is a subgroup of a symmetric group anyway. This is not the modern way to do things. So then another difference, of course, is that we're used to, in classical probability, having certain states be definite in the sense that all of the probability goes away, all of the probabilities will be 0 or 1, but as soon as you get into the non-commutative realm, there will be pairs of random variables that cannot both be definite because they don't commute. And here's an example in the qubit space. these are two, so I'll try to stick to random variable terminology, which I like. These are X and Z in the qubit space are both Bernoulli random variables whose values are 1 and minus 1. And in classical probability language, adapted to the situation, if X is definite, then Z is unbiased, and if Z is definite, then X is unbiased. All right, if you really just take it seriously as a generalization of classical probability, then there should be a central limit theorem. Now here, I can make a bit better comparison with free probability. Of course, in free probability theory, you should have a central limit theorem also. That's one of the defining results of the field. But in a way, that topic is easier because the central limit of free probability is a bounded random variable. And bounded random variables are in many ways simpler than unbounded random variables. In standard quantum probability, you might expect a Gaussian limit. And in this slide, that's what you get, although later I'd like to talk about the multivariate case, where that guess is almost correct, but not quite everything. I'll get to that in a bit. So in the history of central limit theorems, again, taking the usual tensor product, quantum probability with the usual tensor product rather than the free product, the first central limit theorem you might write down is just the usual univariate one, which you might take seriously, which you should take seriously for a few minutes. Okay. So what do? You have a random variable x, and then you center it, you give it mean zero, and then you take a sum of n independent copies, and you see that its scale is of order square root of n, so you divide by that. You get a new random variable x tilde, and you would like to take the limit as n goes to infinity. How do you set up independent copies? In the strictly classical context, you can just assert that the random variables are IID. In the quantum case, you should be a bit more careful, but one thing that works is to take to construct the variable xk in the algebra which is the nth tensor power and whose state is also the nth tensor power. And so then you can just add those fellows. Now, since I swept an interesting question under the rug, I let X be a self-adjoint element of the von Neumann algebra, so implicit, so it's a bounded random variable. So I've just disposed of the most interesting technicality of the central limit theorem. Automatically, X has all finite moments, and so in particular has finite variance. So the classical result is that X tilde, the average fellow, converges in distribution to the Gaussian. Okay, so now here's our first quantum central limit theorem. So quantumly, this is still true, but it's not interesting. It's not really a non-commutative result. It may be true that X lies in a non-commutative von Neumann algebra, but it generates a commutative subalgebra. So it's an interesting remark about quantum probability, but not a new theorem. But multivariate central limits don't look like that. So suppose now you have K elements of K self-adjoint elements of a von Neumann algebra M. Let's suppose also, I didn't say it yet except in the covered region, we're going to assume, of course, oops, my subscripts are terrible, aren't they? Oh, no, I'm sorry, they're correct. They're correct. I want to assume that each XA has zero mean as before. Now, you get average random variables XA tilde for A from 1 through K, but they do not commute with each other. So it's not clear what the statement should even be. What would you even mean by the joint distribution of the X tildes? It's an ironic place to get stuck if you expected a Gaussian limit, because then in the limit, they would hypothetically become closer and closer to commuting, but they don't commute yet. Well, you can sort of cop out. One part of convergence in distribution is convergence in moments. So you could just ask that question. Moments are perfectly well defined because you can make any polynomials you want. In fact, they're sort of more defined than before, and this is, of course, important in free probability where you have moments and cumulants everywhere. You can make polynomials, except you can also make non-commutative polynomials. Well, that's okay, so they're non-commutative. So you have more moments than before because the moments depend on order. So you have a lot of moments, but you can still see what they do. And there's an interesting combinatorial argument that you can apply to this case that tells you that the X tildes converge in moments to Gaussian. And I put the wrong thing on the left here. I didn't mean just one of them. I meant the whole vector of them converges in moments to Gaussian. Okay. Yeah? I'm implicitly assuming a state, but on this page it can be any state you like. Oh, that's a good question, which I anticipated because I put Gaussian in quotes. Well, we'll see. Well, it looks wonderful. It even still looks wonderful when you go through the proof of the Yuri von Waldenfels theorem, except that a problem appears. Okay. You remember at the end of the proof of the theorem that the covariance matrix in this setting doesn't have to be symmetric. So how can it be a Gaussian if it doesn't have a symmetric covariance matrix? Well, there's a clear-cut generalization of that. As was suggested in the question, there is a generalized Gaussian, which is a terrible name. One of its names is a quasi-free state, and it is a state on the CCR algebra. And I wish I knew another name. I could just call it a quantum Gaussian. That's a name that I would prefer. But in any case, that's what it is.
What is CCR?
Canonical commutation relations. I know, but I still have something else to say. The point is, you can view it this way. The covariance matrix doesn't have to be symmetric, but it is Hermitian if you step through the algebraic formalism that I have. Rho is a self-adjoint dual vector, and the X's are self-adjoint, and you get from that that M is Hermitian. You also get that it's positive definite, Hermitian. So it has its real part is symmetric. Its imaginary part is something new. So what is it? It turns out that in this Yuri von Waldenfels theorem, and in all of these non-commutative central limit theorems, all of the non-commutativity does disappear, except for one little bit. It all decays away, just like all of the non-Gaussian features decay away, except for one little bit that scales at the same square root of n rate. Namely, the expectation of a commutator of two of the XAs scales at the same rate as the Gaussian itself, so that doesn't disappear. So in the limit, I'll call the limit G's, I guess, for Gaussian. The commutators don't have to all vanish, they have to be constant. So that's what the non-commutative Gaussian is. You have an algebra with some generators whose commutators are all constant, and then there's a Gaussian state on that. But the bigger problem is So this is a nice problem with a nice question with a nice answer, this quasi-free state business. But the bigger question is, what do you do with this massive moment? What are you really saying if you want some stronger resolve? Okay. Now, I put the motivation at the end. There was a specific reason that I wanted this result. But in any case, here is the result. Suppose the state is tracial, which is this usual definition. That may not look like a very good condition. Most states aren't tracial, of course, but still, there are. It's still the tracial states are still interesting for probability questions. It's better than nothing. After all, in the commutative case, they're all tracial. I guess that doesn't really make this a commutative result in my opinion. No, it's still a very non-commutative result. Then you can at least formulate this. We have a notion, there's a notion of univariate convergence and distribution. Provided you have a self-adjoint element, it has, even in a non-commutative von Neumann algebra, every self-adjoint element has a distribution. So you can ask whether the distribution of a particular self-adjoint element behaves properly in the limit. So for instance, you can take some non-commutative polynomial, which is self-adjoint, and then plug in the x tildes, some non-commutative polynomial p, and plug in the x tildes, and see what happens to the distribution of that evaluated polynomial. So the polynomial could be all kinds of things. You could look, for instance, at the distribution. If you just have x1 and x2, here's an interesting self-adjoint polynomial. What does this do? This has some distribution. It's some non-trivial cubic polynomial in the averaged variables. What does it do as n goes to infinity? Okay, so my result is that if m is tracial, then it does what you expect. It converges to the same polynomial evaluated with, it converges in distribution to the same polynomial with Gaussian random variables plugged in. In this case, you don't have to worry about quasi-free states. Maybe, unfortunately, they're a pretty looking generalization. But still, there's some work to do. That was on my mind.
Okay.
No, it's a mistake. It's a mistake in the slide. Okay. Now, no, it's true, but oh, you mean for commutative? Oh, no, then I don't know. Then it's an open problem. I'll discuss that. Okay. What's true is that I couldn't prove it. The proof requires... Okay. So the proof isn't with the method of moments. See, why would you prove... If you wanted something better than just moments, you still might start with the Urey von Waldenfels theorem because... You might imagine proving the central limit theorem by the famous method of moments, which is one of the proofs of the classical result. And maybe there is a theory like that in general, but I don't know. Okay. Instead, I prove this result with a generalization of the method of characteristics, which is the other standard way to prove the classical central limit theorem. Now, I said polynomials, which is in one way is boring. It has no analysis in it. I think, although I never quite checked carefully, but I'm pretty sure that without many really new ideas, you could replace polynomials by entire non-commutative series. If you would like to generalize polynomials, of course, you should pass to infinite series after that. And non-commutative infinite series look different from commutative ones because the number of terms grows exponentially rather than polynomially. So some things change. It's not clear when you would say that it's real analytic and there are convergence problems. But the notion of entire is still fine. A non-commutative series in infinitely many variables is entire if the coefficients decay super-exponentially. It's faster than exponential, so it overwhelms all of the new problems with having non-commutative variables. So entire non-commutative series are cool. You can plug in matrices and of any size, and they'll converge automatically. So I think the results still works for those, but I never checked all the steps. So let me get into more details about just a better outline of how this result is actually proved. The first thing to do is that I'd like to have a characteristic function. Well, there's more than one choice for how to do that. One kind of characteristic function is this one. You can exponentiate each of the x's, then multiply them in order, and then take row of that. And you get an interesting looking analytic expression, f of t. It is, in fact, the Fourier transform of something of an interesting measure, sigma. The measure sigma is classical in a way. It's a bit like the Wigner measure. You can think of it as a classical measure on R. I shouldn't put x3 there. That should be xk. So it's a classical measure on xk, except that it's not a positive measure. It's signed and can be complex. It could be a signed measure or a complex measure. But in some ways, it's like a probability distribution. It has the property that when you average, I should have put tildes all there. Well, no, just to be consistent, I can just put the tilde on the sigma. Okay, so if you replace the x's by their averages and then call the result sigma tilde, then even though it's a signed measure, it just does converge weakly in the sense of L infinity star or whatever. I mean, it converges weakly in the sense of measures to a Gaussian. Okay. This isn't everything, though. This is very far from everything because this is an ad hoc characteristic function and an ad hoc measure sigma. But once you have this convergence result for this honest but complex measure sigma, then you are allowed some limited change of variables. You can reparametrize each of the x's by powers of them. Okay, so you then get the thing on the left. On the right. This approximation is backwards in a way. Now, rho of this is still not a univariate characteristic function of any kind, because this is a product of exponentials rather than one exponential.
What's the difference between
the left and the right? The exponents don't commute. So. Right. This is a product of exponentials. This is an exponential of the sum, and they're not the same. Okay. But now, here's where I use that rho is tracial. These aren't so different than the arguments of rho are not so different as all that. You can pass from one to the other by commutators. There's a commutator lemma that, see, if this were instead of an exponential, a finite product, then they would be the same except they would be out of order. So, and the difference is a continuous version of that. So you can pass from this to this with commutators. And in this context, there's an ad hoc norm that comes from rho, a Hilbert-Schmidt type norm, where you can say that these are approximately equal with respect to that norm, because you can get bounds on commutators. All right. Now the left side is very good. I could use the distributive law to put the factor of I on the outside. And then I could do a univariate Fourier transform to get that the control on the left side gives you the result for linear combinations of the monomials. So this second step was really the hard one, and it does give you the theorem for linear combinations of monomials. That may still look like a special case, but it's not. I could have all along have taken linear combinations of Vx's, because all of the central limit theorem stuff is stable with respect to linear algebra. And if you are allowed linear combinations of monomials, and if the bases of the monomials are themselves linear combinations, then you can reach every polynomial. That's actually already every polynomial. For instance, if you start with xy minus yx, plus yx, then that's the difference of these two monomials divided by 4. Okay, so that's an outline of the proof. So I was never quite happy with this. I probably should have written it up, though. To go in the direction of one of Dorr's questions, I do have some results for non-tracial states. I can't do polynomials anymore, but I can do distributions of some evaluations. So suppose you have Vx's, and I'm going to put in a capital X because I mean this as a generic, an unevaluated expression, like the algebraic geometers like to say. And suppose you first apply bounded univariate functions to the X's and then combine them. Then in the Banach algebra that that bounded univariate functions generate, if F lies in that, then you get convergence in distribution. And since rho may be anything quasi-free, any non-tracial state, it can be a quasi-free state here rather than a Gaussian. So for instance, I can get convergence in distribution in something like this. Sine x1, sine x2, and then I have to make it self-adjoint, so let's say the anti-commutator of those two. That lies in the Banach algebra that I'm describing. So the reason I mean this is interesting, but the reason I wasn't so enthusiastic is that it's a cop-out. It's just patching the statement of the result so that the argument still works. And instead of the interesting Hilbert-Schmidt type norm in the crucial middle step of the proof, you just use the operator norm. Now this doesn't give you polynomials, which is what I wanted for the original problem, which I'm going to get to. But it does give you something that actually has an interpretation. One of the things on my mind after I had the result was that you can relate it to real physics experiments, because these x tildes may be actual averaged values of quantities. For instance, you may see something like this quantum central limit business in NMR experiments. Okay? Now, in that situation, one thing that you can imagine doing, you could say, these should be x tildes. You could say, the x tildes don't commute, so I have to make choices for how I measure them, but I might just measure them in order. I might measure x1, then after I know its value, measure x2, and so on, or the tilde versions. And of course, you don't measure things precisely in real life. You measure the probability that these real random variables land in intervals. So there's an ordered box probability. If you measure them in a certain order, what is the probability that the values land in a box? And these box probabilities are handled by this theorem, even though not everything is, even though I don't know how to do polynomials. Right. So here's a summary of what I don't know. I don't know the right algebra for the statements of the result, I suppose, so you can then prove it. It's an open problem. If rho is non-tracial and f is a polynomial, I don't have good analytic control, so and I think it's fair to call it an open problem whether you do get this kind of quantum central limit theorem. And actually, I wouldn't be so surprised if it's not true. It seems I'd be a bit surprised. I suppose it's true, but I wouldn't be too surprised, because the behavior of these polynomials, at least to me, somewhat resembles the behavior of the distributions, at least somewhat resembles the old counterexamples to the moment problem due to Stieltjes, where a distribution may not be determined by its moments. So it would be exciting if such a counterexample sort of occurred naturally in this situation. So, here are some other cases where, well, it's known, and none of these exciting counterexamples show up. You just get the quantum central limit theorem that you expected. If the X's start off canonical, that is, if the commutators are all central, or if they're just complex numbers, then the averaged ones converge in distribution to quasi-free. That was actually the historically first quantum central limit theorem that was published even before the Urey von Waldenfels theorem. This one was 1974 or something like that, and Urey von Waldenfels was, I think, 4 years later. So one way in which this is different is that it's just a convolution theorem, or you could view it that way. You can view the average random variables as lying in the original von Neumann algebra, and then you're just convolving the states, and the theorem is that the states converge in the weak star topology or whatever. So then another result was published by my colleague Bruno Nachtigall and Tom Mitchell. They have a kind of de Moivre type quantum central limit theorem, at least for the qubit case. They use combinatorics, in particular combinatorial representation theory, the Clebsch-Gordan rule and all that, to show that if you have any state at all and you have these random variables, then let's say if you have a polynomial, I shouldn't say any polynomial, I should say a self-adjoint polynomial, then it converges in distribution to the quasi-free answer. So I call this a de Moivre type quantum central limit theorem, because that was the first central limit theorem, the combinatorial one. The remarks with the multinomial coefficients converged to the values of the Gaussian, and that was de Moivre's proof. It's a weaker result, though, because it doesn't apply to continuous random variables. And since more recently, there's a related result due to Collins and Snyadi for q bits rather than qubits, where you have d states rather than two states. But I think, I'm not sure, maybe I didn't do this justice in this last sentence. I think it requires tracial states. All right, so this is where the problem came from. There was a theorem that got people's attention for a while because it was related to an even more famous result on the limiting distribution of the shape of a long random word in a fixed alphabet. Long means n letters, and n is going to infinity, but the alphabet is a fixed size. So there's a certain combinatorial statistic for random words called the shape. And you have to change, I should have put lambda tilde or something. You have to shift it a little bit so it has mean zero. As the word gets longer, the shape converges in distribution to the spectrum of a random k by k matrix. It's as if random permutations are behaving like matrices. Now, Johansson showed this, and I should also credit, I think, Tracy and Whittem, because they did the special case of the first row, the first entry of lambda, the first row of the shape. But both Tracy and Whittem and Johansson just sort of did this result directly in classical probability because they knew they could do that because they knew the distribution of the spectrum and they didn't have to talk about the rest of the matrix or anything. So it's just, they treated it just strictly as a classical probability problem. But it's a problem that has a quantum proof. You figure, see, the natural question to ask is, if something is converging to the spectrum of a random matrix, what about the whole rest of the matrix? Well, there are many possible answers for that. The matrix is not unique, of course. But the natural candidate that I thought of is that there's a quantum random matrix. It's a subtle object. It's a matrix of quantum random variables that don't commute. It has a kind of a spectrum, and it has an ad hoc spectrum. Okay, I should say a little bit about the trouble with defining the spectrum of a non-commutative matrix. You can't know the spectrum of a matrix. If you know the spectrum of a matrix, then you know its determinant. But when you take the determinant of a matrix, you're supposing that the entries commute with each other. Otherwise, you don't know how to order the terms in the determinant. Okay. So you have to resolve those questions to define what you mean by the spectrum of a matrix with non-commuting entries. And for instance, in the case of the determinant, a natural thing to do, which is what I did, is to take the average determinant, where you just average over all orderings of each term of in the permutation. So if you define the spectrum that way, then it is close in distribution for long words to the RSK shape. I shouldn't have an M here. It should be a word. And then the other thing that happens is that the entries of M converge to traceless GUE. Well, they converge in different ways. They converge in the sense M is just a sum of independent copies, but the entries don't commute with each other. So the mode of convergence that you need in order to get your Hansen's theorem as a result is the theorem that I proved. Now, you can exploit this relation in different orders, but I should say also that more recently, Collins and Snatty found essentially the same model with other interesting implications. What I would really like to do, and I think I'll end on this punchline, is the following. The really famous result that got people excited was not this one for random words, but an analogous result for random permutations, which then looked like the tail, where the shape of a random permutation looks like the tail of what's called the edge spectrum for large random matrices. It would be nice to get a quantum probability model for that as a way to explain why you get matrices. But I don't know how to do that. So I'll stop at that. Maybe in principle, I would want a specific matrix of quantum random variables where the entries are in a Feynman algebra. And I guess it's possible. I don't understand the Kuhn-Kauss proof. But second, I think it's not known how to read it as that kind of description. It's possible that you could read his proof that way. Well, first of all, I did ask Kuhn-Kauss himself. I didn't ask him about his proof specifically, but I asked him about this question, and he said he didn't know. But I wouldn't be surprised if one can interpret a Kuhn-Kauss proof in that fashion. Maybe if I understood it, then I would be surprised, but... I think it's not lucky enough. Well, so then the question is, well, then I'd have to talk to you about a description. Oh, I forgot my references page. Yeah. I didn't keep track of the recent papers are all in the archive, and the other papers are there, but I didn't do the work to find them. You don't have your tag, but...